You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Israel carries out a major attack on Iran, but the Iranians still have military options for retaliating.
Such as launching ballistic missiles.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll also hear what it's been like living in Tehran through all this. Plus, Nigeria's president offers a pardon for 9 men who were put to death 30 years ago. We speak with the daughter of one of them.
The pardon implies that my father and his 8 colleagues did something wrong. And they did nothing wrong. It was judicial murder.
And we'll hear details about the sole survivor of a deadly plane crash in India.
He told local media that before the aircraft hit the ground, it felt like it was stuck in the air and lights started flickering inside.
All those stories ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Explosions lit up the sky over Tehran, Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem today as Israel and Iran traded fire. It began when Israel launched dozens of airstrikes beginning early this morning. They targeted Iran's key nuclear facilities and also killed several of the country's top military commanders and nuclear scientists. The Israeli military also struck densely populated residential areas in Iran's capital, Tehran.
This man screamed, "Israel is attacking. People are likely dying." 42-year-old Majid was woken up at 3 in the morning. We've agreed to only use his first name for his safety. Majid says at first he thought a storm had hit. When he realized what was going on, he thought about packing emergency bags for his family.
Majid says there were long lines at the gas stations, but he didn't fill up because he was worried he'd waste all his gas waiting in line. And when he walked around his neighborhood, he said there was a long line at the local bakery as people looked to stock up on provisions.
Israel and Iran have been locked in a proxy war for years, but the Israeli attack that began early this morning and continued into today is unprecedented. Iran responded by firing hundreds of missiles and attack drones at Israel. Most of them were intercepted. Iran's supreme leader issued a recorded statement today saying that the Israelis started this war, which he called a great crime, but that Iran will not let them get away with it. For more on what's happening and what could come next, we reached out to Sina Azodi. He's an assistant professor of Middle Eastern politics at George Washington University.
What really changed the situation was the October 2023 attacks, which significantly escalated tensions between Iran and Israel. But attacks of this scale, we have not seen one before like this, that Israelis would launch an attack inside Iranian territory, decapitate the majority of Iran's top military brass, attack nuclear facilities, and assassinate nuclear scientists. There have been civilian casualties. 75 people are reported dead by Iranian media. So I think the attack was audacious. I don't think Iranians were expecting it.
Now, the Israelis say this was a preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear program. How much damage has been done at key Iranian nuclear facilities by this attack?
Well, first of all, the argument that it was a preemptive attack does not stand as from a legal perspective, because there was no planned attack from Iran against the Israelis that the Israelis preempted. But what we've seen is that Natanz has been hit. We don't know the extent of damage. We know that Fordow was not attacked, but this doesn't mean that the Iranian nuclear program has been stopped. You could say that it has been delayed or slowed down, but Fordow is operational, and Iranians just announced that they have a third enrichment facility.
And Fordo is one of the sites where nuclear enrichment is happening?
Yes. So there was Natanz. It was the first enrichment facility that Iran inaugurated. Then Fordo was created, I believe, in 2010 or 11 as a redundancy, as a backup plan in case Natanz is attacked. And then just yesterday, the Iranians announced a third enrichment facility. So you could make the argument that, yes, Iranian nuclear program has been slowed down, but not destroyed.
And the Iranian nuclear scientists who've been killed, how much of a blow is that to Iran's future nuclear activities?
I'm not aware of the exact involvement of them, but one of them, Fereydoun Abbasi, was, let me put it this way, the Israelis previously tried to assassinate him. He survived the attack. And he was then promoted to the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, the AEOI. And now this was the second attempt on his life, which was successful.
So who are Iran's most important allies right now, and how have they responded to this attack?
Well, I have to refer you to the Persian sense of loneliness, that the Iranian leadership has always believed that Iran is alone and nobody will come to their assistance. They think that they are lonely in the region, and most of the countries don't like them. Now, whether the Chinese would help Iran, I see it unlikely. Chinese have traditionally have a tendency of flatter Iranians. But when it comes to practice and actions, they don't do much.
And of course, it has like Hezbollah and Houthi rebels, but they're not able to do much in this situation, are they?
Well, the Houthis signed their own ceasefire with the Trump administration. Hezbollah has been weakened by the previous Israeli attacks. I cannot say that they've been eliminated or that they have no offensive capabilities. They're quite limited. Houthis could do something. They could attack Israelis' interests. But I think should Iran decides to respond, I think they will try to do it from their own territory. And they've already invoked, in their letter to the Security Council, they've already invoked their right of self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter. So I think Iranians will try to do something from their own territory, such as launching ballistic missiles. I don't think that the 100 drones that Iran launched was the only response that they had. I think there is more coming.
In the day before this Israeli attack on Iran, the country was negotiating with the U.S. over its nuclear program. Where do you see those negotiations going now?
Well, I think the Prime Minister of Israel just torpedoed the nuclear negotiations with Iran. I don't say it's impossible, but I say it is very unlikely that under these circumstances, Iranians would go to Oman and talk with Stephen Witkoff, which is President Trump's special envoy for Middle East and who's also negotiating with Iranians. The optics are very bad. They could look extremely weak. And even at a negotiation table, they will have not many playing cards. So I think that for both political reasons and technical reasons, they would avoid talks. And plus, we have to keep in mind that it doesn't matter whether the United States says that, it was not involved in the attacks. From the Iranian officials' perspective, the Israelis are doing Trump administration's bidding in the region.
Sina Azodi is an assistant professor of Middle Eastern politics at George Washington University.
Knife crime in Britain has nearly doubled in the past decade, with more children than ever ending up in the hospital with stabbing wounds. Now, survivors of knife attacks, youth workers and activists are suggesting ways to stem the violence. One of those suggestions, swapping sharp kitchen knives for blunt-tipped ones. It's one of several ideas put forward ahead of a major conference on knife crime being held in London today. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
Leanne Lucas was teaching a Taylor Swift-themed dance workshop to 26 children in Southport last July.
What happened before the incident was just pure joy. We were just having so much fun.
A couple of hours after the class started, 17-year-old Axel Rudicabana walked into the dance studio. Lucas says she thought he was there to pick up one of the kids, until he produced a knife.
A third child has died in the stabbing attack in the British seaside town of Southport. The girls were 6, 7 and 9 years old. 5 other children in a critical condition in hospital, as well as 2 adults.
Lucas was rushed to hospital critically injured. In the weeks that followed, she told Sky News recently, something her medical team said always stayed with her.
The life-threatening injuries I have were the ones that were created with the tip of the knife, and they're the ones that put me in critical care, which led me to nearly dying.
Even today, watching her friends cooking with a sharp-tipped blade can be triggering, she says. Kitchen knives are the most common type of weapon used in knife homicides in the UK. And Lucas is launching a campaign calling for households to replace those pointed kitchen blades with blunted ones. Some of those working to reduce knife crime in Britain are sceptical, though.
I had mixed opinions on that.
Samir Khattab is from St Giles Trust, a charity that helps young people facing poverty and disadvantage.
It could save a life. So I'm not going to knock it, but I'm a real one. I'll tell you how it is. And from what I see on the front line, partnered with my lived experience, it ain't the solution.
Khattab is a trauma caseworker. He meets with young people who end up in hospital with stab wounds or other violence-related injuries. If they want to carry a blade, he says, they'll find a way. And there's lots of reasons why they do it.
Some are bored, yeah? Some carry out of fear and believe it's a survival, you know, mechanism to keep them safe. Some want validation. Some will do it for ego. Some just think it's cool.
When he was a teenager growing up in London, Khattab says he rarely went out without a knife.
Before you left home, I think there was a famous song on X Factor, I wear my keys, wear my phone. And back then it was the same notion, like, where's my key, where's my phone, where's my weapon? And you just felt naked, as we say in the hood, like just leaving an area. And sometimes you never had conflict. You just felt that you had to be carrying. The problem with it is, because I'm carrying, I'm probably going to end up using.
Khattab did end up using. At 18, he was jailed for a gang-related murder. Today, he says, his experience helps him connect with the teenagers he works with. But tackling the issues that drive them into knife crime is complex. Poverty, abuse, bullying, school exclusion, they all play a part, he says. As does social media.
Mate, what are you doing? Get back!
There are countless videos like this one online showing teenagers with machetes trying to attack.
It not only glamorises it, it normalises it, it desensitises you to content.
Patrick Green runs the Ben Kinsella Trust, an anti-knife crime charity in the UK.
If you type in zombie knife, ninja sword into many social media platforms, the algorithm will just keep sending you that content. And often in that content are people trying to take you off site to sell you these knives.
Green chaired today's conference on tackling knife crime in Britain. Machetes and zombie knives, as they're known, those large blades with serrated edges, were recently banned by the UK government. That's real progress, Green says. But online retailers still need to be monitored, he says. After the deadly assault at the dance studio in Southport last year, police raided the home of Axel Rudakabana, the 17-year-old attacker.
Inside, they found chaos. In the lounge, a knife on the sofa and electronic devices full of images of war and genocide. And there was more in his bedroom. Under the bed, a machete.
The knife that Rudakabana had used, he had bought on Amazon earlier that month. Green backs Leanne Lucas's call for more households to use blunt-tipped kitchen knives. And he says one police force in Kent is already trying it out.
The police are actively visiting young people who've been caught with a knife, which they've taken from home, coming back, talking to the parents and helping the parents dispose of the pointed knives in their kitchen and replace them with rounded, safer knives.
It's a small step, Green says, but it's a change that might, one day, save someone's life. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Hey there, it's Marco Werman along with Carolyn Beeler, your hosts.
We hope you think that the journalism we do adds something to your life. Maybe it helps you understand the world around you a little bit better or sparks your curiosity about a place you've never been before.
We're able to bring you critical reporting about news and current affairs around the globe because listeners like you support the work of our newsroom. From now until June 30th, we have a goal of raising $25,000, and we're hoping you can help us reach it.
Thanks to a generous donor who has already stepped up to give, your donations will be matched 2-to-1. That means if you give $25, we get $75. A $100 donation means we'll have $300 in the bank to fund our journalism. Whatever amount you can give helps us bring you news from around the globe 5 days a week.
We hope you will seriously consider supporting our work. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to donate.
Thank you so much from everyone here at The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We've got an update for you on yesterday's devastating Air India plane crash when a Boeing 787 jet plunged into a medical college shortly after takeoff. 240 people are presumed to have died on the plane, and Indian authorities now say that at least 50 people were killed on the ground. Emergency crews are still sifting through debris in the northwestern city of Ahmedabad, searching for answers and working to identify the victims. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel is following the story. Jeremy, when we heard from you yesterday, there was only one survivor of the crash. Is that still the case?
It is. And while this is an unimaginable tragedy, Carolyn, the story we're learning about the survivor is truly miraculous. His name is Ramesh Vishwakumar, a UK national. He was in the area visiting family and was headed back to London on this flight with his brother. And he told local media that before the aircraft hit the ground, it felt like it was stuck in the air and lights started flickering inside. And then next thing they knew, it crashed. Here he is describing the experience. He says everything happened in front of his eyes and he doesn't know how he survived. And he says he thought he was going to die too, but when he opened his eyes and realized he was alive, he unbuckled his belt and escaped. Now, Carolyn, Vishwakumar was sitting in seat 11A, which appears to have been the closest seat to the plane's emergency exit. Mm-hmm. And the side of the plane that he happened to be on opened up into the bottom floor of the building that it crashed into, while the other side was totally sealed off. So he managed to walk through a broken emergency exit into the rubble and escape before the area was engulfed in flames. And he's now recovering in the hospital where he recently met with India's Prime Minister Modi.
It is just an incredible story of his survival. But as you said, that 300 or close to 300 deaths is just devastating. And I wonder if the destruction has made it difficult for workers to recover and identify victims. The fact that, you know, this hit a building. What do we know at this point about those victims?
Not much. And part of that does have to do with just how destructive the crash was. This is a dense area where the plane hit the dining area of a local medical school. But looking at footage and images from on the ground, you can really hardly tell at all what was there. It's rubble. It's entirely scorched. And medical officials say many of the bodies are burned beyond recognition, which has led to an incredibly difficult situation for victims' families who are now just waiting at the hospital. But Carolyn, we do know at this point the identities of some of the hundreds of people who were killed, including a former Indian official from the state where the crash took place. A school in London says that two of their students died. And we've also learned that two people from Gloucestershire in England died alongside their 4-year-old daughter.
And more of those names and stories, I'm sure, will continue to emerge. Investigators have been combing through the crash site and watching video footage of the flight's takeoff, searching for answers. Do we know anything new about what caused the crash?
At this point, it's all purely speculation. It's really too soon to say anything with certainty. Now, some of the key clues about all of this could come from the black box that was on the plane. This is a device that records flight data and cockpit audio exactly for this purpose, to determine what went wrong. And according to police who spoke with Reuters, a black box has been recovered from the site. Mm. That said, this investigation, which Indian officials are conducting with the support of experts from the U.S. and Britain, it could take more than a year to complete.
The World's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, thank you so much for catching us up.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Que Quienes nos quitan la calma nos sembraron miedo.
The name of this song is Sin Miedo, which means without fear. The tune has become a rallying cry at women's marches across Latin America. The voice belongs to Vivir Quintana, a Mexican singer and songwriter whose music has been embraced by Mexico's feminist movement. The World's TV's Isaiah caught up with Quintana in Mexico City to talk about how she's trying to transform traditional Mexican music.
Corridos are Mexican folk songs known for their dramatic stories of betrayal, crime, and power, usually from a male point of view.
Soy el jefe de jefes, señores. Me respetan a todos niveles.
But Vivir Quintana's corridos are different. They're all about women.
En un hotel me atacaron.
Bueno, pues es un disco que tiene 10 temas, que son 10 casos reales de 10 mujeres que se defendieron de alguna agresión sexual.
Her new album is called Things That Surprised the Audience. It features 10 corridos, each one telling the story of a woman imprisoned for defending herself from domestic violence.
Le arrebaté por cansancio la vida a un hombre malsano.
This song is about a woman who fought back during an abusive relationship during the pandemic, killing her aggressor and ending up in prison. The song is told in her voice from inside herself. Vivir Quintana spent nearly a decade researching these cases. She's visited women's prisons across Mexico and built relationships with the women whose stories she tells, many of whom are still behind bars.
No nada más contar sus historias, sino acompañar sus historias.
It's not just about telling their stories. It's about spending time with them, singing with them, and bonding, letting them know someone cares and will come back, she says. Many songs in the album use traditional northern Mexican instrumentation, with guitar, accordion, and tuba. But there's one backed by the Budapest Symphony Orchestra. Quintana's album is deeply personal, but it's also political. She wants to change the kinds of stories that Mexican popular music chooses to tell, especially within the corrido genre.
Que dentro de este género que es tan violento, que es tan machista, que es tan misógino.
She says the lyrics of corridos have often been violent, sexist, and misogynistic. In recent decades, a subgenre known as narco-corridos have become more and more popular in Mexico. These songs glorify drug cartels, hitmen, and violence. Some Mexican states have banned live performances of narcocorridos, saying that the songs promote a culture of violence. Vivir Quintana says censorship isn't the answer.
Yo no estoy a favor de la censura ni de la cancelación de los géneros musicales, sino más bien estoy a favor de la reparación.
She says she's not in favor of canceling genres. She believes in repair and in making room for new narratives.
Vámonos, pues.
With her new album, she's publicly denouncing the judicial system in Mexico, where women face major obstacles to report crimes. For Vivir Quintana, her music is not just to be heard, but to make people listen. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah, Mexico City.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. In Colombia, religious leaders are calling on politicians to tone down their rhetoric as incidents of political violence have people on edge. Earlier this week, 7 people were killed as rebels bombed police stations around the city of Cali. Last week, a would-be assassin shot presidential candidate Miguel Uribe, who's still recovering in the hospital. From Colombia's capital, Bogota, Manuel Rueda reports.
Dozens of people show up every night outside the hospital where Senator Miguel Uribe is being treated to pray for his recovery. At the hospital's main entrance, a group of Catholics says Hail Marys, next to an altar where there are candles and photos of the candidate. On the other side of the building, a group from an evangelical church sings and asks God for a miracle. The presidential candidate was shot in the head at close range on Saturday as he spoke to a small crowd in a park. The attack has sparked fears that security is backsliding in Colombia as criminal groups take on increasingly bigger targets. It feels like we're going back to the 1990s, says Claudia Gomez, a supporter of Uribe who showed up at the hospital to pray for his recovery. She was referring to the time when it was common for drug cartels and rebel groups to target judges and presidential candidates. I feel like we have the enemy breathing down our backs now, she says. Although the attack on Uribe has been widely condemned by Colombians, it has also led to finger-pointing and bitterness. There's no information yet on who may have ordered the hit. But politicians from the left-wing government and the opposition are blaming each other for the country's violence. Religious leaders in Colombia have been urging both sides to dial down their rhetoric. Fernando Ramos is a pastor at the International Charismatic Mission, an evangelical church whose members have been showing up at the hospital. We need our leaders to be more sensible, he says. They need to stop blaming and condemning each other, because that's where violence begins. The assassination attempt on Miguel Uribe comes as animosity grows between the government and the Senate over reforms to Colombia's labor laws. Uribe is against the changes that have been proposed by President Gustavo Petro. In a message on X this week, Petro suggested that the attack on Uribe may have been perpetrated by a group that wanted to distract Colombians from his social and economic policies. The statement angered opposition leaders like Mauricio Cárdenas, another presidential candidate.
Su tarea no es la de ser el provocador, el que incita.
Your job should not be to provoke and incite people, he told the president in a social media video. You should be trying to calm things down. Colombian opposition leaders have also asked for greater security following the attack against Senator Uribe, so they can campaign freely for next year's elections. They say the president needs to tone down his rhetoric in order to prevent more violence. Daniel Briceño is a city council member for the Democratic Center, the same party that Uribe represents.
El presidente lo gradúa uno, lo señala de nazi, fascista.
He says that in his speeches and social media posts, the president often refers to opposition leaders as Nazis, fascists, or enemies of the people, and that the same discourse is replicated by the president's supporters on social media. That generates hatred against us, Briceño says, which is very dangerous in a place like Colombia. Petro says the opposition is trying to censor him, and he says his social and economic reforms could make Colombia a less violent place. This week, he pressed ahead with plans to organize a referendum on the nation's labor laws, even though the Senate had voted against it. I'm just trying to fulfill my campaign promises, Petro said in a speech, where he blamed the opposition for trying to block his every move. Bogotá's Archbishop, Luis José Rueda, recently offered to host a meeting between the president, judges, and congressional leaders so that they can make some compromises.
Desescalemos la acción política de toda forma de violencia.
It's time to de-escalate, he said in a statement, to take insults and threats away from politics so that we can build up this country while taking diverse views into account. In the meantime, many continue to pray for Uribe, who is still in critical condition. The 39-year-old candidate is the second person in his family facing a violent death. His mother, a well-known journalist, was kidnapped by the Medellin cartel in 1991 and killed by gunfire as police tried to rescue her.
It's very triste para el país, pero es la oportunidad de unirnos. Aquí estamos unidos.
What has happened is very sad for our country, says Pastor Fernando Ramos. I hope it serves as a catalyst to unite us. For the world, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogotá.
It is just 1 year away. The FIFA Men's World Cup kicks off in June 2026 across North America. But you do not have to wait that long to see the world's best players on U.S. soil. Tomorrow, the Men's Club World Cup begins in 11 cities across the country, from Philadelphia to Los Angeles. The world's Bianca Hillier is here to tell us what that is. Bianca, what is the Club World Cup?
Hey, Carolyn. So it's when athletes are representing their clubs instead of their countries. So instead of Messi wearing Argentina's blue and white, you'll see him wearing pink and black for his club, Inter Miami.
Oh, okay.
This tournament has been going on for over 20 years, but it might be the first time that many people are hearing about it because this edition in particular is pretty different than previous ones.
Yeah, I have to admit it is my first time hearing about the Club World Cup.
Fair.
How is it different than previous iterations?
Mostly in size. So there used to be just 7 teams. Now there's 32. And the prize pot has really grown. It went from $16 million just a couple years ago to $1 billion today. And the Club World Cup has also historically been an annual event. Starting now, it's going to be every 4 years. And by the way, there has never been a Women's Club World Cup, but they're starting one in early 2028, right before that year's Summer Olympics.
So a lot of expansion there in a couple of different ways, Bianca. $1 billion on the line, that's an impressive number. I'm wondering if this is a big deal for players, or is it still, you know, a bigger deal to play for your country than for your club?
Yeah, it's a bigger deal to play for your country, but there are some players in this Club World Cup whose national teams don't typically qualify for what we consider the real World Cup. So for them, this would be a bigger deal. But for really the top players, this is not a career goal or even convenient, actually. FIFPro, the global players union, released a statement saying that adding this month-long tournament to an already busy schedule is a health risk because it takes up rest time that they would have in between seasons. But as I said, this tournament is now only going to be every 4 years, so that should help relieve at least some of those scheduling concerns.
And that also makes it more similar to what you called the real World Cup every 4 years also. That is happening next year in Mexico, Canada, and here in the States. Is this kind of like a dress rehearsal? Are the host cities kind of trying to get the kinks out with this Club World Cup?
That's exactly it. A handful of the venues, they'll also host World Cup matches next summer. And instead of building new stadiums, like at other World Cups we've seen across the globe, next year's World Cup is going to be using mostly football stadiums. But there's been a lot of work done to make sure that they're ready for FIFA-quality soccer.
What kind of work does that entail, converting a football stadium into a soccer stadium?
Most of it has to do with the actual field of play, because some of these football stadiums, they only have turf, and FIFA doesn't allow that. So they've put millions into making each field ready for soccer. I reported on this last year and spoke to John Sorokin from the University of Tennessee. He's leading FIFA's grass research, if you will, for the World Cup, and has conducted over 80 trials leading up to this tournament.
How the soccer ball interacts with the surface of the different types of grasses we grow, the ones that are warm season grasses versus the cool season grasses.
And Carolyn, it's a funny thing because they're putting so much money and time into perfecting these fields. But once the tournament starts and the athletes are actually using the fields, they don't want people talking about the grass. I mean, if it's working well, it shouldn't be a topic of conversation.
If a defender slips and someone gets around him and scores a goal, you know, then it can compromise the outcome of a game. That's the last thing that we want.
I imagine they're also worried about injuries on turf. Switching gears, Bianca, it's kind of hard to think about a lot of people coming to the U.S. from a bunch of different countries without thinking about the Trump administration's new travel bans and also immigration enforcement. Is any of that having an impact here?
Yeah, it is. There aren't any clubs who are based in the countries listed on the travel bans, but there are about 9 individual players from the banned countries, like Venezuela, Iran, and Haiti. They should be allowed into the U.S. because the travel ban has carved out an exception for athletes and team staff at major tournaments, but there's no exception for fans. And even for people in the U.S., it's obviously a tense time. Multiple U.S.-based fan groups who support international teams say they're going to stay away from matches or even cancel their own watch parties because they're nervous about becoming targets of immigration enforcement.
I'm wondering if you know if ICE or Customs and Border Protection agents have said that they will be at the games.
I asked both of them. Didn't hear back from ICE, but CBP says, yes, they're going to be there for security purposes. And that is standard practice in the U.S. for federal agents to be at major events like the Super Bowl. But what's happening in cities across the U.S. right now is causing people to look at this situation differently. Also, CBP posted on social media recently saying they would be, quote, suited and booted, ready to provide security for the first round of games. The post has since been deleted, and CBP did not answer my request for more information on that. FIFA says they're not concerned about any of this impacting the tournament, and their official line is that the world will be welcomed at these matches.
We will be watching and reporting on how things unfold as the tournament goes on. The world's Bianca Hillier has been filling us in on the FIFA Club World Cup, which is starting tomorrow night in Miami. Bianca, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Carolyn.
2.5 years ago, twin earthquakes devastated southern Turkey and northern Syria. In Turkey alone, the death toll was more than 53,000 people spread out across 11 provinces. Turkey's southernmost province, Hatay, was the hardest hit. Reconstruction is still underway there. But locals worry that while they may get new homes, they could also see the disappearance of the region's rich cultural heritage. From our partners at Deutsche Welle, Yelena Gostoli reports.
Construction sites and the relentless noise that comes with them are everywhere in southern Turkey. The largest reconstruction project is taking shape near Adıyaman, set to house up to 65,000 people when completed. Rows upon rows of identical seven-story buildings stretch into the horizon, standing empty on a hilltop outside the city. In Kahramanmaraş, an identical-looking social housing development project rises near the city center. Two massive banners hang prominently, featuring the portraits of Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, alongside Azerbaijan's leader, Ilham Aliyev, his close ally and a key sponsor of the project. These developments are part of the government's promise to rebuild the region within 2 years. Erdogan said recently that 45% have been completed. But for more than 600,000 people, home is still a metal box in one of the many container cities scattered across the landscape. More than 23,000 people died in the province of Hatay alone. Few have been held accountable. But in one place, the historic heart of Antakya, the cobbled streets remain lined with the ruins of stone houses. Their walls crumbled in on themselves. As the sweet, tangy scent of church candles fills the air, Christians and Muslims pray side by side in Arabic and Turkish, in a city that has long prided itself on its diversity, where faiths, languages and cultures have coexisted for centuries. While most of the population is either Sunni or Alawite, the city is also home to minority groups, including Arabic-speaking Antiochian Greeks, as well as Syriac Orthodox and Catholic communities. Now, many fear that this diversity and its heritage could be lost. Father Francis, originally from Bangalore, India, he has lived in Turkey for nearly 20 years and is one of the Antakyans working to preserve what remains of the city's rich cultural heritage. His church stands tucked away amid the ruins of Kurtuluş Street, once the world's first illuminated street, now swallowed by darkness. The earthquake left it badly damaged, but thanks to support from the Catholic Capuchin Association, the church has been reinforced and partially restored.
The church is a starting point, actually. No, that was my point. My presence and the presence of the church is something which will unite the people, will bring them back, you know. So that's what we started, and it's slowly, slowly paying off. You know, people are coming back.
Turkey's post-earthquake damage assessment report identifies more than 8,000 historical buildings and heritage sites across the 11 affected regions. Along Kurtuluş Street, banners marked Ministry of Culture and Tourism now drape over damaged historical buildings, signaling efforts to preserve what remains. Debbie Ben-Jar Mosque, whose dome and minaret collapsed, is one of 82 historical buildings in Antakya undergoing restoration, led by the Directorate General of Foundations. Adam Bozkurt, the organization's regional director in Hatay, hopes the mosque, which was last destroyed in another earthquake in 1853 and rebuilt in the Ottoman period, will reopen in July.
The special thing about our Habib-i-Necker Mosque is that it is the first mosque established in Anatolia. It has been destroyed 8 times.
The Catholic Church of St. Peter's and St. Paul's, led by Father Francis, is one of the few buildings that was spared by the earthquake. In the immediate aftermath, it became a shelter for survivors. Today, 4 families continue to live here despite the destruction around it. The church community, once numbering around 100, has shrunk to just 20 members. Among them is 60-year-old Isa Jarjar.
Many people either lost their lives or their property. I lost 2 of my relatives, my father and my sister. Our houses were destroyed. We stand up again and try to hold on to life, like everyone living in Antakya. This is not easy. It is very difficult to start from scratch.
On April 5th, 2023, Antakya's historic center was declared a risky area by a presidential decree. Many homeowners in the area remain in limbo, unable to secure permits to restore their historic properties. Meanwhile, some locals have criticized the government's redevelopment plans, saying they were excluded from the decision-making process. They fear the project will force them out and transform the neighborhood into a commercial and tourist center, stripping it of its original character and community life.
Deutsche Welle's Eleni Agostoli reporting from Hatay in southern Turkey. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. On Thursday, Nigeria celebrated Democracy Day. It's an annual holiday that celebrates Nigeria's return to democracy in 1999 after decades of military dictatorship. As part of this year's commemoration, Nigerian President Bola Tinubu pardoned a group of Nigerian human rights activists known as the Ogoni Nine. They were executed by the military government in 1995. Among them was Ken Sarawiwa.
Now, you cannot have democracy without the protection of minority rights. For any society to be properly governed, to have good government also, there must be accountability. What is happening in Nigeria is robbery, is brigandage, is not government.
That's Sarawiwa in an interview from 1993. The families of those murdered men, as well as human rights advocates, have long said that the Ogoni Nine were silenced for protesting against oil companies in Nigeria. That includes the multinational corporation Shell, which denies any involvement in their deaths. Na Sarawiwa is a writer and the daughter of Ken Sarawiwa.
We consider it a step forward in terms of getting a pardon. It's been 30 years coming, and but it's not enough, because a pardon implies that my father and his 8 colleagues did something wrong, and they did nothing wrong. It was judicial murder, and they were treated like murder victims. They were killed and buried in an unknown spot, and we didn't receive their remains for 10 years. That's not how a government treats people it considers to be genuine criminals. That's how you treat people that you want to silence. They were peaceful protesters, activists who were summarily executed. They've done nothing wrong, and there is nothing to pardon. So while I welcome President Tinubu's gesture, we need to take it a step further. Those 9 men need to be exonerated.
Your father was a prominent activist in the oil-rich Ogoni land of Nigeria. Remind us the nature of his activism and what he was hoping to accomplish.
Yeah, my father was a very peaceful activist. He'd been a writer, a poet. He was the education commissioner for River State, where we come from in the Niger Delta. So he was a man of peace. He was very cultured. He believed strongly in democracy and minority rights and in the environment. And he drew up a bill. He called it the Bill of Ogoni Rights in 1989, which was a pamphlet where he called for respect for the environment and for more recognition of the rights of ethnic minorities, such as the Ogoni, who actually own the land where the oil sits on. So that's what my father wanted. And he organized protests, but again, always called for peaceful protests. But the military government of the day and the oil companies felt very threatened by that.
Hmm. The oil giant Shell was involved in oil production in the Niger Delta for decades. Amnesty International, along with members of your family, have accused Shell of complicity in your father's death. What has Shell done in response to those accusations?
Well, there was a trial that was concluded in 2010, and Shell agreed to pay the families and the community some damages. So that's where we've left it.
Did Shell ever acknowledge or agree that they were involved? Have they conceded anything?
No, they agreed to settlement. To this day, the oil companies tend to deny involvement in these things.
What more do you want Nigeria or the oil companies involved to do to address the issues in Ogoniland?
Ultimately, I would like Nigeria to move away from oil, but this is the fundamental problem. The government has always relied on it and hasn't diversified the economy as a result. And so when people like my father come along and try to challenge that status quo, there's a desperation on the part of the government and people who profit from that oil. And we're not benefiting from it. The people who actually live on the land where the oil pipelines run through are still poor. I visited only last year, and you still have oil spills. Some of it is sabotage committed by local actors. But people to this day don't have access to clean water, and they live literally hundreds of meters away from the source of Nigeria's wealth. So not a lot has changed in that respect, that there still isn't sufficient democracy, accountability, a real sense that the people who live on this land are owed at least just the respect of their environment and the ability to farm the land, to drink safe water, and to live lives above the poverty line.
Now, we've spoken about how Nigeria has come to remember your father as a hero. How do you remember him?
Gosh, he was just that. He was a very, very energetic man. He had so many ambitions, not just for himself. He was quite a taskmaster at home, always giving us books to read if we were lying idle, giving us extra lessons after school. So he was very good like that, but always on the go. He was writing books constantly.
And you yourself are a writer like your dad?
Yes, I am. A different kind of writer, but I'm also going to publish a report, I think it's next year or the end of this year, about the last 30 years in the Niger Delta. So I want to sort of continue my father's memory in that way.
Na Sarawiwa is a Nigerian writer and the daughter of Ken Sarawiwa. She spoke with us from London.
For hockey fans, Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Finals was a must-see. The Edmonton Oilers made a comeback for the ages to beat the Florida Panthers on their home ice.
The Panthers dominated the first period, jumping to an early lead that seemed pretty insurmountable.
Back for Edmonton. Pass out and Fox score! It is now 3-0 Florida, Lundell in the final minute.
But the Oilers tied it up in the second period.
Centering pass, Pat Colson with a shot. He scores! Pat Colson ties the game at 3.
The Oilers then pulled ahead in the third period. Their victory looked assured until the Florida Panthers tied it up with just 19 seconds left, sending the game into overtime.
The score stayed at 4-4, and then Sam Bennett of the Panthers came within inches of ending it.
Reinhardt keeps it alive for Mikkola. Across Bennett! Off the post!
The Oilers' backup goalie Calvin Pickard deflected that shot with his glove before it ricocheted off the crossbar. Finally, more than 11 minutes into overtime,
in overtime, the Edmonton Oilers tie the series 2 games apiece.
With that goal, Oilers star forward Leon Draisaitl tied up the best of seven series 2-2. This was the biggest Stanley Cup road comeback in more than a century.
Edmonton hosts Game 5 tomorrow night. Both teams still need two more wins to take home the Stanley Cup. If the Oilers do that, they'll be the first Canadian team since 1993.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. And starting Monday, find our reporting on YouTube. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.